Chapter 11. In spite of his age, the Father Superior reached the door before Gauntlet, Palfrey, or the other two monks. It crossed Charlie's mind that Gregory Scott had thrived on the monastic life. Though he looked a bony wreck of a man, his reactions were the quickest of any of them. "A bomb," Palfrey muttered, as if to himself, as they reached the door and crowded into the cloisters, bunched dangerously together. "It's a bomb," almost under his breath as they surged forward. In a sort of Greek chorus, Fathers Harry and Hugh began chanting, "Who'd want to bomb us? Who'd bomb us here?" as though someone might well want to detonate explosives near them at some other location. The words were repeated and overlapped, and combined with the click-clack of heavy monastic boots on the cloister flagstones. Gauntlet thought he could have set the piece to music. "Who'd want to bomb us? Bomb us here. Who'd want to bomb us? Bomb us." Ad nauseam, like a tediously written church anthem. They reached the gatehouse to find the great oak doors open, swinging in the bitter wind that battered against them, squealing on their iron hinges like trapped animals. Outside there was smoke and wreckage, against which the dark monastic figures were silhouetted, like a 17th-century painting of a military skirmish. Hilary Cook's little Cessna had come to a spectacular end. Deep gouges in the earth marked where the aircraft had slewed off the runway, leaving the cropped scrub at an angle of 90 degrees. The tailplane had been torn away, and now leaned, moving in the wind, close to the runway. Some 50 yards farther on, the wings and centre of the fuselage were concertinaed into a tangle of metal and fabric, while the nose and the engine had careered on to smash into the monastery wall. The propeller blades bent and shattered, having chipped out slices of stone, the whole gushing flame and thick smoke. Roughly halfway between the wings and nose, a pitiful little mound of wreckage marked where part of the cockpit had come to rest, and Charlie saw several of the monks, some with the skirts of their habits pulled up to their waists, running toward this debris. Taking a deep breath, Gauntlet pounded across the turf toward what had once been the cockpit. Closer to the wall, he could see why they'd felt the ground move and shake. Where the aircraft had hit the wall, burying its nose into the thick stone, shredding its prop and exploding, could just as easily have been the concussion point of a shell from a siege gun. The huge blocks of stone had been shattered, cracked, and blasted through as though by a powerful charge. Charlie's nose wrinkled involuntarily, as if he could detect the sweet roast pork smell of burning human flesh that was the reek of an illusion. In that instant he heard deep from his mind a snatch from what he thought was a Bruckner symphony, though he could not be certain, and saw the sudden flash of a large wooden inn sign lurching on its hinges, with a V-shape cut deeply into one corner. Much later he recalled this odd image had come from childhood. The inn sign was from Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, a vivid picture conjured up by that most graphic teller of ripping yarns, and brought into the present by the battle scent of smoke and the squeaking of the heavy monastery door. No wonder they'd imagined it was a bomb, he thought, realizing that other scenes and scents from his early adolescence were crowding into his brain. Memories of the first time he'd visited Berlin in the late 40s, when you could still smell death thick in the air, mingled with the singed redolence of wood and paint. No hard and fast rules govern aircraft crashes and explosions. The literature bristles with million-to-one shots. A man walking from the epicenter of a massive detonation, while everyone else was incinerated. The lone woman staggering naked from the factory, where 200 of her fellow workers perished, when a spark ignited tons of explosives. The child torn from its mother's arms, the lone survivor, as an aircraft blew itself to pieces in a cornfield. So it had been with the Cessna, and somehow, either by design or freak, Hilary Cook had survived, huddled now in a grey ball, lying in a small indentation between the wreckage and the wall. The gawky brother Simon stood over the prone form, his face a stricken mask, while he flapped his arms up and down like an animated scarecrow. "She was taking off," his voice pitched high, as Gauntlet and the Father Superior reached him. "She opened up the engine and was almost airborne. Then there was this bang, and the plane swerved and came apart. It was horrible." Simon's eyes glistened with shock, and he flapped his arms again, as though trying to get himself airborne. Useless, the Father Superior puffed, dropping to his knees by the still body of Hilary Cook, who lay face down on the rocky ground. Lad's absolutely useless in a crisis. Gauntlet moved in on the other side of the girl, and gently they turned her onto her back. She groaned, and Charlie leaned forward, taking his handkerchief out, trying to clean up her face, streaked with oil and smoke. He stopped, wondering at his need to attempt to make the girl more presentable, realizing that he had few medical skills that could really help her now. Her skin was like thin, stretched parchment, grey, almost opaque. He'd seen dead people with more life in their skin tone. "Make yourself useful, Brother Simon," Father Gregory growled. "Get in touch with the mainland. They'll have to send a rescue helicopter with a doctor."
"Yes, Father. Immediately, Father."
Simon sounded like someone out of Chekhov.
"Is she?"
"I've absolutely no idea, young Simon. Just do it." Father Gregory laid his hand across the girl's bruised forehead and murmured a prayer, looking hard at Charlie, who was still trying to clean up the girl's face, and said quietly, "That's not fashionable, you know."
"What?"
"Handkerchief. People use tissues nowadays. They don't carry handkerchiefs around anymore, people don't." Charlie grunted.
"That's just the kind of information I can't do without."
"What do you think?"
"Don't know how I've lasted without knowing about handkerchiefs.
I mean, what do you think of the girl, Hilary?"
"I'm not expert in these things. Don't think we should have turned her over. Don't think that was a good move.
You were giving her the last rites, weren't you?"
Gregory nodded, muttered one more prayer, and made the sign of the cross.
Reflex action. A priest sees someone badly injured, and he goes into the prayers as though a doctor's whacked him on the knee. Hilary lay curled and limp, as though she'd made an impression into the earth, which was impossible, for most of it was solid rock. There was little substance about her body. Her head lolled, and her limbs seemed almost detached. There was no sign of blood, however, and her breathing seemed deep and natural. Charlie tentatively felt her arms and legs for broken bones. He found himself being unreasonably concerned about her, and supposed there was something he very much liked in her. He had found her quaint. That was the best word for it. Quaint and offbeat. Things that he admired in people because they were characteristics that he shared. "You're neat, Charlie. Neat and a shade weird," Bex had once said of him. Now he was worried that Hilary might have some terrible internal injury, and was about to die on the cold, rock-hard ground. "Jesus," he said to himself, then realized that it was a prayer, not an oath. "Young girls," he thought. "I hate it when young girls get killed." For a moment he felt quite frantic. Then he was aware that the Father Superior had motioned most of the monks away, though little groups of them still worked on the bits of wreckage. The smoke stung at Gauntlet's eyes, and when he screwed them up, the monks in sight changed shape, became mobile Giacometti sculptures, skeletal, thin, and emaciated. They appeared to move jerkily like marionettes. A few weeks before, Charlie had watched a pop group on television, fascinated by the oddity of the hip-hop, near-spastic movements as they danced. The fans crowded around the group, seemingly in ecstasy at the strange, jerking way these young people danced with exaggerated movements, taking huge steps, as though they were negotiating a series of small fences on the apron-sized dance floor. Now, through his blurred vision, the skeletal monks looked as though they were doing the same odd steps.
"They're getting a helicopter up as quick as a flash."
Brother Simon was back, still flapping, breathless.
"You have no medical personnel?"
Charlie asked of Father Gregory.
"Wouldn't you know it?"
The grizzled old priest made a face that for a moment turned him into a gargoyle. "Father Martin's our doctor. Took sick last week. We had to send him to the mainland. He's pretty poorly."
Shaking his head. "We desperately need new blood."
"What's wrong with your Father Martin?"
Gregory wrinkled up his face. "Old age. He'll be 94 at Easter." For a second or two, Charlie reflected on the wisdom of a community of aging men living on an inaccessible island.
He presumed that the younger brothers did most of the heavy work. "What you need," he began, "is a district nurse."